Middle East Studies at Marine Corps University presents Afghanistan, War of Necessity or Quagmire, presented by Ambassador Peter Galbraith. This is the third lecture in a series entitled A Multidisciplinary Approach to the AFPAC Region and Its People, being hosted by MES at MCU. Ambassador Galbraith has served in senior positions in the U.S. government and the United Nations. Most recently, he was Deputy Special Representative of the Secretary General of the United Nations to Afghanistan and an Assistant Secretary General of the UN until October 2009. From 1993 to 1998, Ambassador Galbraith was the first U.S. ambassador to Croatia, where he mediated the 1995 Erdut Agreement that ended the Croatia War. Ambassador Galbraith is one of America's foremost experts on Iraq, having been a regular visitor to the country since the early 1980s. As a staff member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he uncovered Saddam Hussein's murderous Al-Anfal campaign against the Iraqi Kurds. This presentation took place Thursday, 25 March 2010, from 1400 to 1530 in the GRC, Quantico, Virginia.
Guidance for Afghanistan into the Marine Corps PME programs. And if you're interested in learning about the series or getting copies of the first two lectures, which was one was on Pashto poetry and the second one was on Afghan historical narrative, please see Adam's sites in the back. And also, I personally, and I think we all should thank Adam for putting all of this through and, basically chaperoning this program from infancy. So please see him, and we have them for you, and we are publishing a book after all of this is done in August. This afternoon, we are privileged and indeed honored to welcome His Excellency Ambassador Peter Galbraith to speak to us. Ambassador Galbraith's lecture title is Afghanistan, War of Necessity or Quagmire. The ambassador, who until October 2009 was Deputy Representative of the Secretary General of the United Nations to Afghanistan and an Assistant Secretary General of the UN, will discuss, among other topics, the controversial presidential elections in Afghanistan last year. The topic of elections and continuity of governance and expansion of accountable and transparent governance are two of the top five points in the guidance issued by General Stanley McChrystal. And as goals to a successful conclusion of the Afghan mission. Back to Ambassador Galbraith. In addition to his UN position, Ambassador Galbraith served from 1993 to 1998 as the first U.S. ambassador to Croatia, where he mediated the 1995, I will pronounce this wrongly, Erdut Agreement that ended the Croatian War. Beyond his expertise in the Balkans and Afghanistan, Ambassador Galbraith is one of our country's top experts in Iraq, having been involved in that country since the early 1980s. As a member of the United States Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he uncovered Saddam Hussein's genocidal Al-Anfal campaign against the Kurds and others, but mainly against the Kurds, which was going on from 86 to 89, and I think the height was 88, if I'm not wrong. And before giving the floor to Ambassador Galbraith, I want to express our sincere thanks to Ms. Tracy Benson for going beyond the call of duty, I would say, and trying to arrange this with us. Without further ado, please join me in welcoming Ambassador Peter Galbraith. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Tursey, and thank you for inviting me here. And to Adam Seitz for all of your help and logistical work, and to Tracy, who was my assistant in Newfane, Vermont, volunteered to come with me into Afghanistan in the United Nations. And somehow I'm back in Vermont, and Tracy's still in Afghanistan, but so she's here doing this on leave. I pose the question, Afghanistan, a war of necessity or quagmire. But in fact, we don't need to answer the first question, a war of necessity, if in fact it's a quagmire. By which I mean a conflict from which we cannot win. If, in fact, there's nothing we can do within a reasonable time or horizon, and with the resources that we are prepared to commit to bring about victory, however defined, then it frankly doesn't matter whether it is important or not, because even if it's important, if we do not in fact have a winning strategy, it doesn't make sense to deploy the kind of resources that we are deploying, because as everyone here knows better than any other part of our country, military resources are not free resources. They're not free in terms of the money. They're not free in terms of the lives. They're not free in terms of money that is spent on the military is not available for other purposes. I am told that the cost of the surge is equal to the annual cost of the health care bill. But leave aside the domestic versus national security trade-offs, which frankly are not always persuasive to a part of the political spectrum in this country that doesn't actually believe in domestic programs anyhow. It doesn't make sense in these resources are not free in national security terms. That is to say, if we put 100,000 troops into Afghanistan, we do not have those troops and all the support that goes with it to meet other national security challenges, whether it's Iran and its nuclear program, or if the goal is to combat al-Qaeda and global terrorism, if we put all these resources in Afghanistan, or do we have the resources then to deal with other problems where, in fact, other places where almost certainly al-Qaeda is more present, obviously tribal areas of Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, probably Europe being, excuse me, I'm just getting the pointer here, being places where you have a larger al-Qaeda presence. So let me just turn to the question of whether, in fact, is this a winnable war? Let me say I have the highest regard for my colleagues and friends who are in the administration, and for General McChrystal, with whom I worked when I was in Afghanistan. But I think we have to be clear about what General McChrystal's assignment was. He was asked to come up with the best possible strategy to win the war in Afghanistan. He was not asked the question, and I think perhaps appropriately, you might say it was above his pay grade, he was not asked the question, will the best possible strategy work? Is this war winnable? Now, as General McChrystal understands, and I think everybody does, the center of gravity in this conflict is the people of Afghanistan. And that is true of a counterinsurgency strategy. But in order for the key element of a counterinsurgency strategy is, of course, to have a credible local partner. It's obvious if you have a campaign as we have in the Helmand River Valley, you go into Marja, you clear the Taliban out of Marja and understand what happened. There were some who stayed and fought. There were many who, when we came in, left, either just going back to their villages or blending in with the local population. Some who went south or possibly east to Pakistan or other parts of Afghanistan. But there's no doubt that we can go into a place like Marja and that we can secure it at some cost. The question then, of course, is what next? Because obviously we don't want to be in Marja forever. And in order for us to get out of Marja, we need what? We need an Afghan National Army that is capable of providing security. We need an Afghan National Police that is capable of providing law and order. We need an Afghan government that is seen as capable of providing honest administration and essential services, and which can win the loyalty of the population. And then when you have those elements, you can get on to the other parts of General McChrystal's 12 points, which include jobs and economic development. But we have to ask, do we have those key elements? Is there an Afghan army that can provide security? Is there an Afghan police that can provide order? Is there an Afghan government that can provide provide essential services, honest administration, and win the loyalty of the population? I think there, and the answer to the question, all these questions, is no. Probably we are closest to having an Afghan army that can be a partner. And there are people who are much more expert on that, and I won't say more, but it clearly is not able to secure these areas on its own. But that might be an achievable goal. We are very far from being able to have an Afghan police that can operate like a police force. And in fact, I don't think we can achieve that at all, and I'll try to come back to that. But the most important element is there is no Afghan government that can provide honest administration and win the loyalty of the population. President Karzai has been in office for 8 years. What has the previous 8 years been like? It has been an administration that is characterized by ineffectiveness and corruption. It is the, Johnson said of second marriages, the triumph of a hope over experience. But in this case, it goes beyond that to think that somebody who has operated as he and his administration have for 8 years is somehow going to be reformed and improved in the next 5 years. Without the fact that he is in office for this latest term as a consequence of massive electoral fraud. And there is no doubt about the scale of this. There were 6 million votes recorded in the August 20th, 2009 presidential elections. And Mr. Karzai was recorded as having about 3 million, roughly half. We know that at least 1 million, but I suspect the figure is closer to 1.5 million of the votes for Karzai were not cast by voters. They were, a certain number of them were manufactured in ballot stuffing operations, but probably the largest number never existed at all. They were simply reported without people actually voting. And this is what I call wholesale fraud. There are really two kinds of electoral fraud, and it's very important to distinguish them. What I call retail fraud and wholesale fraud. Retail fraud goes on in almost every country in the world. It takes place in American elections. Not, I want to add, in the state of Vermont, but in states that don't have quite the same high standards that we do. But it goes on. People voting twice, maybe some ballot stuffing, maybe denying some people the right to purging people from the voter rolls. And in Afghanistan, there's no doubt, as in the recent Iraqi elections, there were elements of retail fraud. There was indelible ink, and it's clear that some people figured out how to wash off the indelible ink and vote twice. I know this because I went out observing on Election Day, and I saw some of this. But the fact is, the number of people who are going to be going around to different polling centers doing repeat voting, there's only so many hours in the day. If it's a very close race, yes, that could make the difference. But in Afghanistan, this massive fraud didn't take place that way. It took place because the institution that was in charge of the election, the so-called Independent Election Commission, which was all of whose members were appointed by Karzai, who was, of course, a candidate for re-election, that body itself perpetrated the fraud. In each and every instance of fraud, it was committed by the staff of the Independent Election Commission, or the staff cooperated with those who committed the fraud, or in the most benign cases, the IEC staff knew about the fraud and did not report it and did nothing to prevent it. But in each and every case, it was the body that was carrying out the election that was committing the fraud. And furthermore, in the most blatant ways, the IEC made partisan decisions of benefit to Karzai. For example, the IEC had a regulation that it had published, that it advertised to the donors who paid for the election, because although it was an Afghan election, the Afghans couldn't pay for it. It was paid for by $300 million in aid from Western donors, $200 million from the United States. The IEC advertised that it had regulations that to prevent fraud, and one of those regulations was that it could that any obviously fraudulent ballot would be excluded from the preliminary count. Well, when they discovered that Karzai, that applying that regulation would mean that Karzai would be below 50% of the vote and there would have to be a runoff, they discovered, having been in operation for 6 or 7 years, the day before they're about to announce, the day they're going to announce the preliminary results, they have a revelation. They finally read the Afghan electoral law and discover that it does not allow them to exclude any ballots, including obviously fraudulent ones. And so they had to include the ballots. The result is that Karzai was over 50%. The result was that then there was a protracted process to determine that there would be a runoff. And then when it finally was determined that there'd have to be a runoff, the commission took a number of steps to guarantee it would be more fraudulent than the first round. Namely, although the challenger said, please fire the staff that committed the fraud, they rehired them. The challenger said, please, there were, you know, these ghost polling centers, about 1,200 of the 7,000 polling centers never actually existed, and this produced most of the phony votes. Incidentally, if you're going to commit fraud, basically, on a wholesale way, you need to have the people who are running the elections on your side, and you need to do it in places where there are no candidate agents, no observers, and, very convenient, no voters. Because if you have any of those things, people are going to notice the fraud. So they had about 1,200 places which never existed, but which you were able to report results, and nobody could say, no observer could say, I saw fraud there, because, of course, it didn't exist. So anyhow, the challenger, former foreign minister Abdullah wanted those reduced, eliminated. The election commission said they were going to have even more polling places. Under those circumstances, he rightly said he wouldn't ask people to risk their lives to turn out and vote. This story, though, I tell because it underscores the situation that we now have, which is that a President Karzai, who, as I said, his term was characterized by 8 years of corruption and ineffectiveness, is now in office by virtue of massive fraud. and is seen as illegitimate by a large part of the Afghan population. Let's see if I can. This is a, and this has a very significant ethnic dimension to it. Afghanistan, although, and this is one of the things that as strategists I will caution you against. As Americans, we are so used to talking about other countries, other peoples, as if they were just like us. So we talk about Iraqis as if there were a as if there were such a people. When in fact, at least 20% of Iraq, the Kurds, you call any of them an Iraqi, he's deeply offended. And every Kurd, including the president of Iraq, who's a Kurd, wants an independent Kurdistan. And in Afghanistan, while there isn't separatism, there are different ethnic or national communities, and certainly the non-Pashtun ones are very conscious of their identity. And in this election, the election passed, Karzai was a Pashtun from the majority community, from the plurality community, 45% of the country. Incidentally, none of these statistics are terribly reliable because there hasn't been a census since 77, so a few years. And Abdullah, who oddly was in some ways the most, Abdullah, the most Afghan candidate running, since his father was a Pashtun and his mother was a Tajik, was for a variety of reasons seen as a Tajik. From the community, that's 25%. But so basically, in addition to the fact that a lot of Afghans who didn't vote for Karzai see him as illegitimate, there is a particular sense in some of the Tajik areas, maybe not all, but some of them, certainly the Panjshir Valley and Mazar-i-Sharif, that Karzai is not legitimate, and that the local power brokers say that we're just not going to recognize him as president. That does make it complicated if you're viewing him as your credible local partner. But beyond that, he also, the fraud did not win him admirers in the Pashtun community. In fact, it's, I think, fair to say that the fraud and the crisis that followed it, the crisis that followed the decision of the IEC to include the obviously fraudulent ballots, those months in September and October were the time that the Taliban had their greatest gains from their point of view since 2001. Not only was their Afghan enemy discredited in Afghanistan, but actually the fraud also undercut support in the troop contributing countries. So in that sense, it played very well for them. If your strategy depends on a credible partner and it doesn't exist, what is it then that you can do? Again, if these resources aren't free, then why keep them committed to this particular struggle? I do not argue, however, in favor of a total withdrawal from Afghanistan. We've been there for 8 years. We have accomplished things. And I don't. If we withdrew, then we would sacrifice lose a lot of which a lot of money and lives have already been sacrificed. But I think if you cannot accomplish the counterinsurgency mission, then you might think in terms of what it is that you can accomplish. Let me come back to that in a second, but simply to say, if I persuaded you that the war cannot be won, now I'd like to persuade you that the war cannot be lost. In the sense that we will not see a Vietnam-style end to this war. We will not see the Taliban knocking down the gates of the presidential palace in Kabul. In fact, the Taliban cannot take Kabul. They couldn't take Kabul in the 90s, but for the fact that they went there on the tops of Pakistani tanks. And presumably, we have enough interest, enough power, enough staying power to prevent a rerun of that. Also, the Taliban are not particularly popular. Just to say a word about the Taliban. I said that we tend to talk about, Afghans, but when you get below that and look at the national groups, you understand that the Taliban is a purely Pashtun movement. It has no support among the Hazaras, who are Shiites. The Taliban being a Salafi Sunni movement, view the Shiites as apostates. And when they were in power in the 90s in the Hazarajat, the Central Highlands, the what color is that? Purple? Yeah, purple on the map. They engaged in great massacres. And we don't know the scale of these massacres, but there are bodies to be dug up and investigation to be held. And I think those people are owed justice. They don't have any significant support among the Tajiks. And the Tajiks have certainly an outsized position in terms of militarily and otherwise in Afghanistan. So basically, while the Taliban can control large parts of the countryside, they can control many neighborhoods in Kandahar, Afghanistan's second largest city, they cannot take over. They cannot take over the country. So we cannot eliminate the Taliban. We cannot bring the insurgency to an end because the absence of a credible local partner. And on the other hand, the Taliban themselves can't defeat us, even if we withdraw. And that then leads me to, if you can't win, what might we still accomplish? And I would argue that we can prevent infiltrations into the non-Pashtun parts of the country, and thus facilitate development in those parts of the country. And we can help secure Kabul. We can continue to conduct a counter-terrorism mission in the Pashtun areas. And probably we can also help ensure that the government control is able to at least fly the flag in a place like Kandahar. They won't control the city, but they have the governor's palace and with sufficient security so that that doesn't get overrun, even though there's no way that the governor or his people could go shopping in the main bazaar because they might get their throats cut. It's not a happy outcome, but it's one that would be much less costly. Let me say a word about the way we have approached strategy in Afghanistan. General McChrystal has rightly recognized that at the root of the problem is governance. Governance and elections are a couple of things on his agenda. And indeed rule of law. But the way we've approached it is to say, yes, this is a problem. Here are the resources that we have in the United States. We have people who know about governance. We have people, lawyers who know about rule of law. We have people who can train police. We'll put them in and create programs. But it doesn't necessarily mean that these programs are going to work. They are supply driven. They're driven by what we can supply. And I would urge, as a strategic matter, that we take a closer look at Afghanistan and see whether we can meet the needs of the country. And it may be that we simply don't have the kinds of skills and resources that are available to meet the needs of the country. So bringing in our program to train Afghan judges, we may get trained Afghan lawyers, but we may not get justice in Afghanistan because we really haven't looked at the root cause of the problem. And what can I say about the root cause of the problem in governance? It is that the way in which most Afghans experience government is in the form of abuse of power. I speak drawing on the very substantial expertise of the people who worked for the UN and some of my own experience. Afghans are not, I think, so upset at the lack of good government services because this has not really been part of the Afghan experience. But what they see is local power brokers, and note the word I didn't use, it didn't say local officials, local power brokers, sometimes called warlords, abusing their position and getting away with it, operating with impunity. So that in Kandahar, a village, a local power broker comes, he takes away the orchard from a village. The village goes to court and gets a judgment restoring the orchard. That would be a remarkable achievement. Wouldn't really get that far. But they do. And then it's not enforced. They still can't get their orchard back. And in that sense, then, they lose faith in the government. Doesn't make them supporters of the Taliban, but they're not going to be supporters of the government. And training people on anti-corruption measures, how to provide honest administration, training judges, isn't going to solve that problem. So I would argue for a strategy that looks more at the problem and how we solve it. Another thing that's not going to solve the problem is the removal of bad officials, bad actors. We in the West have a view that if you're out of office, you're out of power. But that's not the case in Afghanistan. It's quite easy to remove the governor of Kandahar for abuse of power and corruption. You put in his place this rather nice agricultural economist from Canada. I'm partial to agricultural economists from Canada. My father was one. But you put in place an agricultural economist from Canada, and he can say all the right things, very presentable when the visitors come, when the ISAF military officers visit, the diplomats, the journalists, but it doesn't mean he can actually do anything. And power is really still held, in part, by the Karzai family and by Karzai's half-brother. So getting people out of office and getting them out of power are two different matters, and we, in our very linear way, have focused very much on getting them out of office, and we haven't broken the power that they have. And I'm not sure that I see any real way to do it. Let me look at another element, the police. About 80% of the recruits into the Afghan National Police are illiterate. And many of them come from villages where, let's say, they don't have the skills that might be required to live in barracks with large groups of men. They get a 8-week training course, although I was told recently it's now down to 6 weeks. Some of it is focused on basics, including things like hygiene. And a lot of it's focused on how you survive. And then at the 6 weeks, they're graduated as policemen. But of course, they're not policemen. Now you could say, the obvious solution, we need to have a year or two training program for police. In this country, many police academies are more than a year. But why don't we do that? And of course, police would have either a high school or a college degree. The trouble is, you do that, you teach them to read and write, you teach them policing skills, and at the end of it, they're not going to want to be policemen. They will be much too well qualified for that job, which, incidentally, in the south of the country involves sometimes as high as a 10% casualty rate per year. That's not a very appealing job if you have some other option. Let me turn to the question of whether I hope I've persuaded you that it's a very difficult to see a path that will work. Let me turn to the question of whether this is really a war of necessity that justifies 150,000 of the best troops in the world. Let me first say it's important to consider how asymmetrical this conflict is. We have more than, or will have, more than 100,000 U.S. troops. I think at a cost we were calculating of $100 billion a year, and $1 million a soldier. I hope I have the math right, the right order of magnitude. We are taking on an enemy which has at most 30,000 troops, enjoys the support at most of 15% of the country, 30% of the Pashtuns, 15% of Afghanistan as a whole, 30,000 not particularly well-trained insurgents, part-time soldiers, fighting the best militaries in the world. And we're at something of a stalemate. What is the Taliban cost of the insurgency? I think the CIA estimated at 70 million. Other estimates are at 200 million. 70 million or 200 million versus 100 billion. That is not a winning formula. So let us ask how important this is. Well, obviously, the justification for the Afghanistan war, 9/11. And that was also the justification for the Iraq war. But the Afghanistan war really did have something to do with 9/11. The attacks on the United States did originate from Afghanistan territory by al-Qaeda, who were sheltered by the Taliban. But because that happened in 2001 doesn't mean that al-Qaeda is still there in the same way in 2010. And I think all the evidence suggests that they're not. And that there are, as I said earlier, a number of countries, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, that must be higher priorities. The second argument is that, Afghanistan isn't all that important, but Pakistan is. Pakistan is a country of 180 million. It has at least 60 nuclear weapons. It is very unstable. All of which is true. And it's important to consider the instability in Pakistan. I try to describe it as both horizontal and vertical. Vertical, in the sense that it is like Afghanistan. It is an ethnically very divided country. And there is, in Balochistan, which is the largest province, there is a very significant ongoing separatist insurgency. Balochistan is the largest by geographically, but the least populated, with 5% of the country. There is a latent insurgency in Sindh, based on resentment of the, which is 25% of the country, based on resentment of the Punjabis, who are about 60% of the country and who dominate the military. About 90% of the military are Punjabis, 10% are Pashtun. 10% are Pashtun. The Sindhis and the Baluch are essentially unrepresented. You do have a country that has a lot of internal division, and it has a significant conflict between Sunnis and Shiites as well, with thousands dying in those fights. We have also the Pakistani Taliban insurgency in the tribal areas, and in the spring of 2009, we had the roughly there, isn't it? The Pakistani Taliban taking over SWAT, and that led a lot of people to say, "My God, they're only 60 miles from Islamabad," and 60 miles from Islamabad and the nuclear weapons. But that, because they were were in SWAT didn't mean actually that they were, there was any prospect they would make it to Islamabad, that the Punjabis would allow the Pashtuns, a Pashtun radical movement, to take over the country. That was not in the cards. Maybe they take over the tribal areas, maybe they could take over SWAT, but they were not going to march down to Islamabad and seize the nuclear weapons. Another point about Pakistan is, while Afghanistan truly was a failed state, most of the state structures operate in Pakistan, even in the tribal areas. It's not actually a state in collapse. There is another difficulty in Pakistan. I described the vertical division. There's a horizontal division in Pakistan, and that makes diplomacy very difficult, which is that there is a civilian government of President Zardari and the PPP majority in parliament that's in office, but not in power. There is the army, which has been in both office and power for about half of Pakistan's history, usually disastrously, and which is always the real power in the country. Within the army, there are the inner services intelligence, which is a kind of shadowy government within the, if you will, it's shadowy institution within the army, and then there are supposedly rogue elements of the ISI. You could come to a state within a state within a state within a state. And the difficulty is that in a normal relationship with a country that had a more unified chain of command, you could say to them, shape up or there'll be consequences. But in fact, the civilian government would very much like to do things we'd like to see it do. Better relations with India, definitely deal with the Taliban. After all, the president's wife was murdered by the extremists. Reduce military spending, put a focus on development. But we try to pressure and actually get out of Afghanistan, not be involved in Afghanistan. Try to put pressure on the civilian government. It doesn't work because they don't really control the people who are power. You're in fact weakening them vis-a-vis the army. I think President Obama made the wrong decision on the surge. I think the administration's policy on Pakistan has been very successful, and is paying dividends. And those are seen in increased cooperation against the Taliban and in the tribal areas. Actually for much of the last 30 years, the relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan has been one of what I described as mutual contempt. First Zia and then Musharraf would lie to the American president, and the American president would say, oh, okay, indicate that he accepted the lies, when every professional diplomat and otherwise knew that these guys were lying. So the Pakistanis had contempt for us because they could get away with our lies, and we had contempt for them because we knew they were lying. And it was really an unhealthy relationship. And I think what's happened now is that we've gone away from that. We don't accept the lies. And as a result, we're getting actually some real results. But to come back to the connection to Afghanistan, I don't see it. Instability in Afghanistan is not going to cause instability in Pakistan, except arguably in the tribal areas. I certainly agree that Pakistan is a major player in Afghanistan, but it doesn't mean that it goes the other way around. So, if in fact Al-Qaeda is not, if Afghanistan is rather low on the list of places where Al-Qaeda is present, if in fact a continued Taliban presence in Afghanistan really does not threaten the core areas of Pakistan, what is it that is of necessity in Afghanistan? Well, the Afghan people, and we've certainly, over the years, we've done a lot to help them. There's been a huge amount of economic progress since 2001, and in many ways the society is transformed. There are the rights of the religious minorities, like the Hazaras, which were very brutally repressed. And of course there is the cause that is very popular in the West, and popular because it's right, which is of course the status of girls and women. But again, the question for us is, what level of commitment do we wish to make to that particular cause? Let me stop here in terms of my formal remarks and open it up, if I may, for questions.
Thank you very much. If you have questions, please raise your hand and identify yourself, and this will come to you, actually.
Professor Galbraith, you raised lots of questions. It needs really a debate to clear up most of the points that you raised. But I just want to make a comment and then ask you a question, which is very important for Afghanistan. You correctly said that the Karzai government has been in power for 8 years, and very little has been achieved, and we cannot expect much in the next 5 years. And you gave the reason why that was so, with which I agree. I can't see the international forces staying in Afghanistan more than 5 years. Now, if the international forces leave in the next 5 years, which will also be the end of Karzai's government, what will happen in Afghanistan? Then the same war and the same terrorism and everything will start all over again. So my question is, when we had this enormous fraud in the elections between the first two people, actually the second person that you named, Abdullah, his father and mother are both non-Pashtuns, but his father used to work in the New Delhi in the 1950s, an American project, and that's his claim to be a Pashtun. And he's not very proud of his father, that's why he uses his own name twice, and he's called in Afghanistan Double Abdullah. But anyway, number three and number four were two people who fought clean elections. The first one was, who came number three, is Ramazan Bashar Dost. He's from Hazara group, but he's got a PhD from France. And the fourth person is even more important, famous person, is Professor Ashraf Ghani, who came fourth. So when Karzai is so corrupt, and when Abdullah is spent exactly the same amount of money, was as corrupt as Karzai, why are we keeping Karzai in power? What is it? Why should Karzai continue when there is nothing that he can deliver? Why don't we bring the other two people, third and fourth, so that they can form a government? Or why don't we go to the Afghan history so that we can organize a government like the Afghans have done throughout the histories from Lui Jirga, which will bring the leaders from all the groups from all over the country and they will decide? Or there are many other ways that Afghans have formed the government, but this one is not a very important one, and this is not going to be democratic or acceptable to Afghans. Thank you.
The first point, to respond to your point about the elections and the merits of the candidates, it is for the Afghans to choose, and indisputably the top two candidates were Abdullah and Karzai, even if many observers might have preferred another alternative, particularly Ashraf Ghani, who I admire greatly. But he actually only ended up with, 1 or 2% of the vote. And even if you think that in an honest account he might have done better, maybe really it was 6 or 7%. It was a small percentage. Even in this country, we don't always have elections involving the best people. At least it's been known to happen. The second point about an alternative form of government is a point that I agree with you in a rather specific way. I think it's actually a very, very important one. Afghanistan has a structure of government that is totally inappropriate to the country. It has a Napoleonic system of government, which is a system of rule by a single man in a highly centralized state. But in France, when Napoleon imposed it, going back, I mean, of course, there were earlier traditions, Louis XIV and so on, it was in a entirely homogeneous state. Everybody was French, and Napoleon was Napoleon. Karzai's no Napoleon. And Afghanistan is an extremely diverse country, both ethnically and geographically. And I think it may be worthwhile looking at Iraq, actually, as an example of a country that very much fractured along ethnic lines, where you have a constitution that entrenches power sharing and that, in my view, has enabled Iraq to survive, which it wouldn't have without this particular arrangement. What are the features of the Iraqi constitution? First, it is a parliamentary system in which there's basically a figurehead president. And in order for the parliament to form the government, there are a variety of supermajority requirements, two-thirds. So you have a country that's 50% Shiite, 20% Kurdish, 20% Sunni. And basically, you have to bring into the cabinet all of those groups, and not the Sunnis and Kurds that are chosen by the Shiite Prime Minister Maliki, but Kurds and Sunnis who genuinely represent their communities. And that contrast to the Karzai cabinet, where yes, of course, they're Tajiks and Hazaras and so on, but he chooses them. They're his creatures. They don't really necessarily represent their own community. And so when you have that kind of system, yes, there's a huge amount of negotiation that takes place in the cabinet. And it's been very difficult to get decisions on controversial issues made in Iraq. But the parties in Iraq all have a vested interest in the bargaining and the political process as opposed to violence. There's a second feature of the Iraqi constitution, which is also very important, which is it's a federal system with a very high degree of local self-government. In the case of the Kurds, who really want to be independent, the constitution allows them to be independent. Own flag, own army, own parliament and president. They have the power to veto the application of any federal law in Kurdistan or amend its application. And other parts of the country could have that same level of autonomy if they wanted it. So in Afghanistan, it strikes me that among the reforms that might be considered is to have elected local government with legislative, budget, and tax authority, and a system perhaps of a mixed system with a president with some responsibilities, maybe like in France with defense and foreign affairs, and a prime minister chosen by the parliament with this kind of bargaining, so everybody's there. I don't think that is a solution, because it doesn't deal with a lot of the entrenched problems, including the fact that many of these local officials, power brokers, you'd still have the problems of abuse of power. But I think it would be a step in the right direction. The trouble is, how do you get there? I mean, the Pashtuns are basically opposed to this model. And they're the majority. Or not the majority, but they're the largest group.
Which actually is kind of derivative from the question that you asked, but I'll rephrase mine my way to see whether you want to embroider on it a little bit more. The second one is more complicated. We'll get to that in a minute. The first question, having to do with the elections, in a society that is quintessentially tribal, as Afghanistan's is, the Pashtuns represent overwhelmingly the major tribe, the largest single ethnic group. And Abdullah, whatever his other merits, was never going to be accepted as being Pashtun, whatever else he might have been thought of to be, Tajik or otherwise. Is it plausible to think that any national leadership, whether an election is fair or unfair, is going to emerge which is not dominated by Pashtuns? And the question that logically follows on that is there any reasonable, plausible alternative to Hamid Karzai? That's the first question having to do with the elections. The second question, taking off from the topic that was put for this this lecture and your question, Afghanistan quagmire or war of necessity. Do we, for our purposes, speaking as an American, do we have to have a strong, capable national government? You said a couple of minutes ago that Afghanistan has been endowed, either by themselves or by outsiders, with a Napoleonic strong government at the core. Yes, that would superficially appear to be the case, but in fact, Afghanistan has been governed for centuries, mostly by, whether you call them warlords, provincial governors, or some other formula, by the leader of the Tajiks, the leader of the Turkmen, the leader of the Kyrgyz, the leader of the and et cetera. Is that, for our purposes, given that our enemy is not so much the Taliban as it is Al-Qaeda, and we need to continue operating against Al-Qaeda, do we need to have a homogeneous national government in Kabul? Or can we make do with whoever is in power in Kabul, simply making his peace, making his arrangements with the different warlords, while we operate on a training mode to train the Afghans, the Afghan National Army, the Afghan police, and other institutions of Afghan society to the best that we and others can do while focusing our war fight against Al-Qaeda?
Thank you for that question. Sometimes in these things, one speaks in a bit of shorthand, and I should have taken the next step, which is to say, yes, it has a very centralized constitution, but as you point out, that doesn't mean it actually is a centralized state. Not at all. I mean, not at all. It's a bit of fiction. Because Karzai doesn't exercise authority in the Tajik areas, not really in the Uzbek areas, and even the Pashtun areas, because obviously a large part of those are controlled by the Taliban. And there are other reasons why it inherently wouldn't work. I mean, after all, the French system is based on an extraordinarily capable professional administrative service that goes to the, you know, one of the best academic institutions in the world. And Afghanistan, these appointments are, the professional civil servants have very little capability, and otherwise they're, you know, political rewards and so on. So I don't think a strong, achievable government, it doesn't exist, a strong central government. I don't think it's achievable, and I don't think it's desirable. And that really was my point in talking about the Iraq example. In both cases, the Bush administration supported a strong central government. I mean, in some sense, you could think this is a bit odd because, you know, they come from a party that kind of espouses weak government and states' rights. But they, you know, this model of states' rights, they didn't actually seek to apply it in the two countries where they ended up fighting these wars. And in both cases, it made sense. Now, in Iraq, the Kurds, particularly, because they were well organized and disciplined, were able to thwart the Bush design on the Constitution, and they ended up with an exceptionally decentralized state, which worked. But it was a bargain between the Kurds and the one of the Shiite religious parties. That was the basic deal. Afghanistan, I think, partly because the Afghans who participated in the bond process and the constitutional jirga really weren't very familiar with these concepts. And they were steamrollered by Zalmay Khalilzad, himself a Pashtun, in favor of a strong centralized state. They saw in the line, but it wasn't actually implemented. But I think this is absolutely something that we should sit back and think. What is our bias when we engage in these nation building exercises in favor of strong central governments? Why do we believe that's going to produce, why do we believe we can achieve it? And even if we could achieve it, why do we believe it would produce a better result? Especially since it doesn't accord with our own national experience and approach and philosophy. It's striking.
Part of, I guess, part of the equation to ascertain whether an war is winnable or quagmire, in addition to looking at our components of that strategy and so forth, is look at the other side of the equation, the Taliban, the enemy side. And one of the almost uncritically examined comments among many in the United States, maybe even most, is that, gosh, we can't let the Taliban win, because if they do, then the Al-Qaeda would be welcomed back in with open arms and they would again start planning, you know, New York Part 2 kind of thing. But that doesn't seem to me to be an automatic assumption. In fact, I would think that from what I've read and stuff from a lot of the Taliban folks, that they're very well aware that they are on the run now and have been fighting for 8+ years. Because they welcomed the Taliban in the first time, I mean the Al-Qaeda in the first time, and it seems that they would be much less likely to do so in the future, not to mention the fact that the Taliban themselves, if they did sweep back into power, they would then have an address again, as they did the first time, and suddenly our strengths are decisive in that. So they're aware of that, of course. So the real question is then, from your perspective, what actually is their desire and objective? What do they want to accomplish so that they can have some sort of power but not be afraid of, you know, that tomahawk knocking on the door in the middle of the night kind of thing, which ends the world quickly? Thank you.
Well, first, Karan. You've asked a hypothetical question, because I don't think there's no prospect that the Taliban will sweep back into power. Even if we left completely, short of, you know, allowing Pakistan's ISI to run things, they just aren't going to get back. So what we're really talking about, and maybe from the way you present it, you know, maybe it might be a more stable result if they did. But although it would be very unwelcome, I'm not advocating it. But we're simply not going to have an address in the way you describe it, because they aren't going to come back to power. What happens, frankly, if we reduce our forces greatly, I don't think the situation's going to be really any different than it is now. The Taliban are going to be in the countryside. They'll control the neighborhoods of Kandahar, but probably not the governor's office. But they aren't going to be able to, you know, they can launch attacks because of the sort of ethnic mosaic into some of the northern areas, but they aren't going to actually take control. Now, what is it? It's a little unclear as to what it is they want, and that's one of the dilemmas. And I suppose, precisely because from their point of view they have to be thinking that they're doing very well, when a side's doing well, it often doesn't focus on exactly what it wants. And it's also hard for them to think that they aren't going to win, even though they aren't. You know, if you're doing well, you think you might win, but look at it from their point of view. They are able to launch more attacks in 2009 than in any year. They're killing more U.S. Yeah, there are more NATO troops there. They're killing more of them, of course, as a result. They are at the center of the world's attention in a way they weren't before. they have every reason to believe that the U.S. and its allies don't have the staying power. So what is the incentive for them to negotiate? The strategy that we have is based on somehow defeating them and then thinking that they might settle some bargain. But their time horizon's not the same as ours. And anyhow, we haven't been able to defeat them. Let me just say a word about something else that's been in the news, which is negotiations. Particularly those conducted by the UN, by Kaidi. I'm not very fond of Chi Eide, for those who followed my disagreement. But nonetheless, I'm going to set aside personal feelings and tell you like it is, which is to say that Chi Eide is a serial exaggerator. There were no meetings with significant Taliban figures. He had meetings in Kabul, and I know about this. He had meetings in Kabul with people who claimed they had connections to the Taliban. There are a lot of people who come forward, some charlatans, some who once had a position with the Taliban. People like to be players. It doesn't mean they actually have any influence. Nothing significant happened in the 2 hours that he was in Dubai for these meetings. So the suggestion that he made publicly, which got a lot of attention, that the arrest of Mullah Baradar disrupted negotiations that were ongoing is pure nonsense. The arrest of Mullah Baradar was a sign of a more serious U.S.-Pakistan relationship and was a tangible evidence of a U.S. foreign policy success.
Hi, Richard O'Hara from the British Embassy. Actually, your last comment set me up very nicely for the question I was going to ask. We're expecting this peace and reconciliation jirga to happen in Kabul towards the end of April, maybe early May. And in terms of sort of serious negotiations, obviously we'll all have seen the reports this week of President Karzai meeting with a delegation from Hezbi Islami Gulbin. How likely do you think it is that we actually at this jirga could sort of see what will probably once was an unimaginable thought of actually Karzai stood hand in hand with Hekmatyar here on the stage? And what do you think the implications would be if something like that happened? Thanks.
I mean, aside from my wishes for a while.
Hekmatyar is one of the most despicable figures in all of this, in many ways more despicable than Mullah Omar. He's the Ratko Mladic of this, the guy who destroyed Kabul. And he's also, in a way that the Taliban were not, very much a creature of our creation, because basically we let General Zia and the ISI decide who it was that got the billions of dollars of U.S. weapons in Charlie Wilson's war, when we certainly had influence to say to them, hey, Soviets are a bigger threat to you than to us. You want our weapons? We'll decide who gets them instead of building up one of the worst figures. The press reports, the account of Hekmatyar always says, associated with but not part of the Taliban. It's a pretty important phrase. So I don't know that a deal between Karzai and Hekmatyar is going to make very much difference to the core struggle, which is between the government and our side, if you will, and the Taliban, where they're an organization which has clear command and control. So I also am not much persuaded that you can make deals with local Taliban commanders that are going to materially change the outcome. I think in the end, if there's going to be a negotiated settlement, it's going to have to take place with Mullah Omar and the top leaders of the Taliban. And who is it that can make that happen? Pakistan. Who are the governing councils of the Taliban? Let's see, it's the Quetta Shura and the Peshawar Shura. And those happen to be capitals of two of Pakistan's four provinces. And we know that ISI has contact. We know that the Quetta Shura is met in Pakistani cantonments. So I'm not really very convinced that this process is going to go very far. But I do think there should be a negotiated settlement. And frankly, I think that's going to have to involve Pakistan.
Ryan Tepperman, a graduate student at Georgetown. You pointed out that one of the major problems we have in developing local governance in Afghanistan is that the local governments cannot enforce its authority over people because the power brokers there simply have too much power to be countered by local governance. Given that U.S. and ISAF forces are providing security and trying to empower these local governments through and balancing, I guess you could say, the powerful local authorities that are not necessarily part of the government, why do you think that strategy which emphasizes local governance versus centralized government, or a strategy which emphasizes local control in the countryside versus a centralized control in the cities, would not be a viable form of Afghan governments, I guess?
I do think a decentralized system of government, elected local government with real power, is an improvement over the current arrangement, which, even if you thought a centralized system was desirable, and I have to tell you I don't believe centralized systems are desirable in these circumstances, but even if you did, it isn't going to work. The dilemma, though, is this. The local power brokers, the local warlords, whatever you want to call them, they are power brokers because they have power. And we can spend a lot of time wishing that other people had power, and I'm sure in almost all these cases we do wish it, but that doesn't make it happen. And in that sense, a strategy which frankly involves working with the power brokers, including the armies that they may, or troops that they may be able to mobilize, in the end, that may be a more effective strategy than a strategy that involves trying to build centralized institutions, a not very effective army, a utterly ineffective police with no prospect of success. It doesn't mean that it produces a very appealing result, but it may conform better to the reality in Afghanistan. I will say that, again, that kind of system is what worked in Iraq. There's a great deal of discussion about the surge in Iraq as being the key, but that isn't what really changed things. In Iraq, we ended up with basically ethnic armies. There were the Peshmerga, who were the most mobile and effective force and remained that way in the country. When we wanted to deal with the Sunni insurgency, the reason we had success is that we funded the Sunni sheikhs who created a Sunni army, call it the Sons of Iraq. We pretended it was something that it wasn't. It was really a Sunni army. And then, of course, there's the Shiite army, which is what's called the National Army. And each of these institutions were able to provide order in their own area. The Kurds actually provided assistance to providing order outside of Kurdistan in Baghdad. But do we end up with something like that? Yeah, that may be where we come out. Sorry, you follow up?
We're answerable to the population, whereas the warlords and power brokers in Afghanistan today don't derive power from the population itself. They derive it from drugs, from corrupt, from taxes on the roads, and that sort of thing.
I think you're providing a very generous view of the Sons of Iraq. They were set up by tribal sheikhs who were the henchmen of Saddam Hussein and who profited significantly both in that time but also from all sorts of illegal trade that went across Anbar to Jordan and places like that. So I don't think this was a particularly saintly group of people. I also think, I don't know enough to say this definitively, but I mean, not all these warlords, so-called, I mean, that we use the term warlord, it's so pejorative, but it doesn't mean that these are people that have no support or are operating by imposing their will. One of the notorious warlords of many people's minds is the governor of Balkh, Mohammed Atta,
And I went up there, and you know, frankly, I kind of thought this place, you know, it resembles Kurdistan. I mean, there's a powerful figure, but a lot is going on here. There's a lot of construction. There's a lot of commerce, and you know, maybe people in Balkan and Mazar-i Sharif, and you know, I don't claim any expert. I didn't do a great expertise. I didn't do man on the street stuff. I certainly is a place I could walk around far more safely than in other parts of the country. But you know, you had to think, well, maybe the elite in Mazar aren't too happy with, are not too unhappy. I mean, they may be pretty happy with all that's going on, because you know, things are actually seem to be improving. There's that may be some element of it in Jalalabad with Governor Shirsai.
May I ask a question about two countries you didn't mention and maybe their role in the election?
Their role in the election, or in general, if there's a negotiation or inclusion of other forces, that's Iran and India. India, I mentioned because whatever Pakistan does, their first eye is towards their neighbor in India. And Iran, we hear so much about Iran's involvement, helping the Taliban, funneling money for the elections. Just your views while you were on the ground, how much is Iran involved and how much power they have? And also, is India as involved as Pakistan claims? Thank you.
Well, the answer to the second question is easy, no. I mean, nobody could be as involved as Pakistan claims India is. But this is relative, but I did not form a particularly malign view of the Iranian involvement. It's clear that they have a lot of influence in the Hazarajat and a lot of connections. And in many ways, from a Western perspective, that's the most attractive part of the country. I mean, relatively more liberal and for the rural areas, and certainly for obvious reasons. It's not a place where there's any support for this kind of Salafi jihadi fundamentalism that we have identified as our enemy. And of course, the Iranians, while they may tactically see some advantage in supporting the Taliban, they are ideologically very much opposed to the Taliban. But the short answer I have is that I don't think the Iranians are major factors in Afghanistan, and I don't think they may be malign actors, but I don't think they're major malign actors. And in that, I would distinguish that from Iraq, where they were basically the effect of the 2003 invasion was to install Iraq's best friends in Baghdad. It was to give the Iranians the thing that Khomeini dreamed of and that they fought for 8 years, to give it on a platter. With regard to India, it's active. I don't see this as part of an Indian anti-Pakistan strategy. I see this as part of India as a regional player, even also wishing to build on its partnership with the United States. There's a real asymmetry between India and Pakistan at this point in time. If you went into those countries in the 70s or 80s, the conversation would be about each other. But if you go to India today, if you attend a conference on security issues, it might be all day before the subject of Pakistan came up. I mean, you know, in some sense, they've moved on. They think of Pakistan kind of as, when we have insecurity discussions, maybe only slightly more often than if we had discussions, we'd be thinking about Mexico. Whereas the Pakistanis, it's the Cold War on steroids. I mean, India's hand is every place. They're obsessed with it. The Pakistani army is. Frankly, I think they live in an alternate universe. Now, it serves their interests very well because it enables them to to claim this disproportionate share of Pakistani resources, which is one reason the country has done so poorly as compared to its peers starting out at the same period of time. I mean, it's a striking thing that at the time of independence, Pakistan's GNP was significantly, per capita, significantly higher than Korea's, or even Singapore's. And a sad thing that where they've ended up with all the talent that the country has today. But there are a number of people in Pakistan that have a different view of India from the army view, including this civilian government. I know Benazir very much wanted to improve relations with India. I mean, partly because she believed in it, thought it was one of her father's achievements, but partly because she understood that if you want to have genuine democracy in Pakistan, you need to get control of the military and also the military budget. In order for that to happen, you need to improve relations with India. I also think the army is maybe beginning to shift a bit of its view, as evidenced by the fact that they really were prepared to devote some resources to fighting insurgents in Pakistan, and that they got a lot of public approval for it. The presence of Indians in Afghanistan is an issue that the people who want to wave the bloody shirt can use, but it's greatly exaggerated. The Pakistani line is there's something like 50 Indian consulates in Afghanistan, which is, you know, it's just nonsense. I don't know, two or three. Colonel? Oh.
If I could ask one last question. In addition to the things that you've mentioned there that have to do with whether the war is winnable or quagmire, et cetera, which is the government, the ANP and the ANA, one thing which hadn't been mentioned at all, and I'd like your view on its central or on just how influential it is in an outcome, is the whole drug trade issue and the nexus between insurgency, the fact that it provides prohibition for corruption of the government itself, and then you know, how the whole insecurity thing makes. How much is it important that also has to be addressed in order to have a positive outcome, or what is your thoughts on that?
It's certainly a factor. It's not clear how large a contribution the drug trade makes to the insurgency. I mean, what is clear, it may be that the largest source of funding for the insurgency comes from the United States in the form of payments made by the companies that transport the supplies to the American troops in order to be able to bring them across from the Pakistani border without getting attacked. And that's a very nice source of income to the insurgency. And it shows the dilemma of such an asymmetric war. You know, we've got to bring in tens of billions of dollars worth of supplies in order to fight the war the way we fight it. And these guys just need $70 million to fight it the way they fight it. And they can get it by getting very small tolls, relatively speaking, on the trucks that are bringing in our supplies. You know, it's kind of the funny thought is that if we weren't supplying ourselves, then maybe their budget to fight would dry up. I just ask you to think, it's the asymmetry of it that is really, that it makes it very difficult from a strategic point of view. I taught for 4 years at the National Defense University. I don't think any place there that we were thinking about wars in such an asymmetric way. I don't know if this is now part of the military PME at this stage, but if it isn't, I don't suppose there's a lot of good doctrine on it at all yet. But it's certainly something that we need to think about. Did I answer everything?
Just the drug trade itself, is that
it's a major source of corruption. Absolutely.
I'd Last question. Sir, thank you very much for enlightening presentation. You began with mentioned Vietnam, that it would not come out that way. A number of us are Vietnam veterans, and we understand that conflict very well. Can you do, in just a few minutes, a compare and contrast Afghanistan with Vietnam, understanding that Vietnam, over a period of time, had lots of dynamics with it, from central government to many central governments, the role of the village chief and so forth, along with the U.S. efforts, advisory, not so advisory. I know it's a large platter that I'm offering to you, and would be interested in your responses. Thank you.
Thank you. There is a major difference between Afghanistan and Vietnam, which is the one I've already called attention to. Vietnam was a war that we were capable of losing, and in fact did lose, because there was an organized state as the enemy, which had quite a large army and which had insurgents in South Vietnam, and which, once we withdrew, was able to triumph militarily. That does not exist in Afghanistan. There is no state that supports the Taliban, and the Taliban their base of support is the 45% that is Pashtun, and they only have, at most, the kind of passive support of 30% of the Pashtuns. I mean, this is, you know, we could argue about the figures, but that's the kind of order of magnitude on it. So it's really very hard to see how a movement without outside support and with inside support from 15% of the country could prevail, except in the most extraordinary circumstances. So that is an enormous difference. But a lot of the other elements of this, unfortunately, have, in my view, some very eerie similarities. Obviously, corrupt and ineffective governments. And to come back to your question about getting rid of Karzai and your question about what the alternative is, you know, maybe if one had a magic wand and could put somebody else in there, I certainly think Ashraf Ghani would be a much better president. But I do think highly of Ashraf Ghani, but to say that anybody would be a better president is not a very, that's not a setting of the bar very high. But how do you get there? I mean, when we manipulated the presidencies of Vietnam, it was, you know, a series of disasters. And so I think we're rightly cautious not to do that, but corrupt, ineffective, a government that does, you know, which controls the capital and the road to the airport. That was the sort of line on Vietnam. I guess the trouble is the airport in Kabul is very close to the downtown, and they don't always control that. But I think many of the analogies I also see, frankly, are in our own domestic politics and the way in which we look at it. I saw a lot of parallels, frankly, to the decision that President Obama made and the one that President Kennedy faced in 1961. In 61, Kennedy had the Democratic foreign policy establishment and the military telling him that he had to double the number of troops and change the mission from advisory to combat. And Obama had the Democratic foreign policy establishment, who, of course, always wishing to appear tough. Since they were against the war in Iraq, their basic argument was, we're really tougher than the Republicans because we want to fight the war that really is the central one. So they were kind of trapped politically, and they were making the case. Again, the military were supportive of this because the military had not been asked, can we win this? They'd been asked, you know, what resources do you need to win it? So they gave the answer, as they should. And so you had those twin factors. In 61, Kennedy rejected, I mean, he stood up to the foreign Democratic foreign policy establishment, he stood up to the military, and in retrospect, of course, that clearly was the right decision. Unfortunately, reversed by Johnson. You could tell, I'm not in the administration, but, you know, reading the newspaper and seeing, you know, understanding things a bit, having been in government, you could tell that the president had a lot of the same hesitation that Kennedy had, but he took the opposite decision. And frankly, we'll see. Lyndon Johnson was the last president to have great social achievement, the Civil Rights Bill of 64, Medicare. But his presidency was undone by Vietnam. The question is, will Obama, who now has the first really big bit of social achievement in 40 years, how will his presidency be affected by Afghanistan? That's an open question.
Thank you. Before we say thank you to Ambassador Galbraith, those of you interested, the next session of this will be on 5th April. We have Professor Shah Mahmood Hanifi of James Madison University. He will talk, his title of his talk is The Pashtun Counter-Narrative. And he will talk actually on something that most Pashtuns believe that they have been the dominant force, and Hanifi will actually counter that. It is very controversial in the Afghan sense, but he will talk about that. And we discussed right now about the question of the integration and all that. We may still have some room for a conference that will be right here on 21st April. Among some of the people who will be coming here would be Lieutenant General Lamb from the British military, retired recently, who is right now the reintegration advisor to General McChrystal. We will have Jelani Popal, who is Mr. Karzai's point man in appointing and moving governors. He's basically his super minister and administration outside of Kabul, and others. And if you want information on that, please again see myself or Adam Seitz in the back. With that, Ambassador, thank you very much for enlightening us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
For further information, please contact Dr. Amin Tarzi, Director of Middle East Studies at tarzia@grc.usmcu.edu, or Adam C. Seitz, Senior Research Associate, Middle East Studies at Seitz@grc.usmcu.edu.